you may or may not agree with, but will generally not be heard on corporate media. You be the judge. No censoring of who's allowed on the debate stage. You're invited to join us as your community radio station, listener-sponsored KPFK, brings you the final presidential debate of 2024. Wednesday, October 23rd at 5 p.m.
Welcome to KPFK, established in 1959 on the Pacifica Radio Network, a broadcast service of, by, and for the people. 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake. People power is on your radio.
This is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Maria Hall, welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I think it's going to be another good one. Maria, what do you think?
Of course. Well, I'm a little biased, but still, I think we have another great show lined up for you today. I am really excited. So first, we're going to speak with Benjamin Kirsten from Jewish Voice for Peace about UCLA's heavy-handed response to the students' Gaza Solidarity Sukkah this week, which was created to call for divestment and an end to the war. Then we'll speak with attorney Carmen Nicole Cox from ACLU California Action about Proposition 6, which would prioritize rehabilitation in California state prisons and end prison slave labor.
Well, that does sound good. The slave labor one is certainly something that has been long neglected, and sadly, the war in Gaza continues. I think we're starting with that one, as you said, so let me introduce our guest on that topic. Last fall, as all of our listeners, of course, know here at KPFK, all across the United States, not to mention elsewhere in the world, U.S. colleges and university campuses were the scene of highly militant protest over the Israeli, U.S.-backed and participated in, really, war in Gaza. Most of these protests were opposed to what Israel and the U.S. are doing in Palestine, calling Israelis' actions there genocidal. Often the pro-Palestine protest included encampments of tents and other structures. University administrators were called before Congress to answer questions from the Republican-controlled House of Representatives about what the House committee were sure were the anti-Semitic nature of the protest and what were these administrators doing about it. Colleges and university administrators reacted in a highly repressive way, arresting their students, suspending them from class, disciplining and firing, forcing out some of their professors, canceling commencement speakers deemed too pro-Palestinian, and the like. Nevertheless, the protests continued throughout this past spring. But by the time students returned to their campuses this fall, across the country, colleges and universities in the meanwhile had created and imposed new and highly restrictive rules on campus political protest. Some would say draconian new rules. I would say draconian new rules. For example, New York University passed new rules, which included the position that any Israeli protest or protest sign that condemned Zionism were per se anti-Semitic. And we'll get to that. And across the nation, these new rules for campus protests, they prohibited the sort of encampments that had been seen the previous year. And while campus protests have continued this fall, in the light of all this, so far they have been fewer in number, and in some way somewhat less dramatic, perhaps. Well, yesterday, this new restrictive environment for campus protest manifested itself right here at the University of California's Los Angeles campus, UCLA. There, Jewish students and other students of conscience erected a sukkah to observe the harvest festival of Sukkot, which continued to demand UCLA divest from weapons manufacturers and other companies enabling Israel's genocide, its occupation, and the apartheid. The sukkah was lovingly decorated with hand-painted flora, and pictures of anti-Zionist ancestors hung from the sukkah's roof. Students, well, they led teach-ins on sukkah, on divestment, and related topics. In the evening, counter-protesters, many of whom had just attended conservative writer Ben Shapiro's talk on campus, came to the sukkah area, harassed the students. Riot police cleared the area, after which counter-protesters desecrated the structure itself. And just this morning, yesterday morning, the Southern California ACLU filed a lawsuit against UCLA for the brutal way it ended a student encampment on its campus this past May 24th. In fact, one of the plaintiffs in that case is our guest today here on the Lawyers Guild. So yes, to help us understand what happened yesterday at UCLA, as well as what is going on around the country concerning these new rules and campus protests, we're pleased to be joined by one of the leaders of the UCLA protest that was shut down yesterday by the campus administration. He is Benjamin Kirsten, a graduate student in the UCLA Department of Art History and a fellow at the UCLA Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies. He's a member and leader of the UCLA and Los Angeles chapters of Jewish Voice for Peace. Well, Benjamin Kirsten, a warm welcome to the Lawyers Guild show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so happy you're here. Benjamin, before we do anything else, remind our listeners what and who Jewish Voice for Peace is and what it stands for. For example, what are its demands with regard to the decades-long occupation of Palestine by what is now the State of Israel? Its demands concerning the current war between Hamas and Israel and the U.S.?
Thanks for that question. Yes, so I organize with Jewish Voice for Peace, which organizes, which is the largest progressive anti-Zionist Jewish organization in the world that organizes in solidarity with Palestinians and also builds resilient Jewish community beyond Zionism. Jewish Voice for Peace it's a national organization with chapters across the country, in cities and at universities. It is intergenerational, multiracial, cross-class. It's really a beautiful social movement of Jews and allies who are really united by the vision of equality, justice, and dignity for all. Those values are what undergird all of JVP's work. Currently, JVP has been part of the larger movement that is really demanding an arms embargo. Last October, shortly after Hamas's attack on Israel, and the what quickly became very clear of Israel's very indiscriminate response and brutal assault on Gaza, JVP and other organizations loudly declared the need for a ceasefire. A ceasefire has unfortunately not happened, and so the demand has escalated to an arms embargo, because we understand that to be the way that a ceasefire will come about. If we want to actually change the behavior of the Israeli government and military, we need our government, the U.S., which is arming, funding, and providing political cover for this genocide, really enabling a right-wing extremist government and its armed forces, we have to actually use the leverage that we have.
Well, Benjamin, before we get into a broader discussion about the pro-Palestinian movement, which is protesting what Israel and the U.S. are doing in Palestine, and of course, what happened Monday at UCLA, tell us about the lawsuit against UCLA in which you're a plaintiff, filed by the ACLU yesterday on your behalf and behalf of others, over how UCLA ended the encampment on the campus this past May.
Yes, so this is really kind of hot off the press. The ACLU has filed a suit on behalf of myself, one other student, and two faculty members. And really at the core of the lawsuit is I think, an idea that many of us hold dear, which is that freedom of speech and expression are foundational principles of our shared democracy, and that the treatment of protesters really across the country has, really cast a pall over our community members' ability to give voice to deeply held political values and viewpoints. So as you mentioned, UCLA students established the Palestine Solidarity Encampment last spring on April 25th. And on May 2nd, the encampment was violently raided by police. And this happened under the pretext of student safety, because the night before, a violent mob had come and attacked the students at the encampment. And what this lawsuit is saying is that the university actually needs to protect students, faculty, and staff in their right to free expression and association. What the university cannot do is shut down the source of speech, rather than instead the university needed to deal with the source of violence. And so that is really what this lawsuit is about. And what we're hoping is, you know, for me, I certainly hope to see some measure of justice and accountability to friends, students, and professors who have student conduct charges against them, which is really, it makes the future uncertain in a very scary way. And also, we're hoping to really send a message to UCLA and to other universities as far as how they deal with the right to speech and expression.
Well, all right, Benjamin, thank you for that. And let's learn now, in fact, what happened more recently, the last couple of days, on the campus of UCLA. Who were the groups involved? That is to say, who sponsored these demonstrations? When was the sukkah or the sukkahs put up? I can't remember if there's more than one. Were there any other signs or displays placed around campus in support of what was going to go on as well? If so, what messages did they convey? Had your group or groups requested permission beforehand to construct the sukkahs and so forth? Tell it all got started. Then a little later, we're going to give you a chance to kind of give us the highlights and downlights, if you will, of the day.
Absolutely. So Jewish students and other students of conscience put up this sukkah. So many of the students involved are also members of Graduate Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace at UCLA. But the sukkah did not come about under the auspices of any one organization. The students who, including myself, who erected the sukkah, we intended to observe the fall festival holiday of Sukkot, which is, it has a layered set of meanings that are really beautiful. The holiday really evolves around building a temporary structure outside and taking your meals in there and inviting guests in. And so as a holiday, it really evokes a sense of community and collective vulnerability. It asks how we are in touch with the rhythms of the earth. And of course, with this imagery, it's impossible to not think of the Palestinians who have been forced to live in tents, some of which the Israeli military has then bombed. And so for me and many others, we had the overwhelming feeling that we could not observe Sukkot as normal this year. And so we erected the sukkah on campus to continue to pressure our institutions to end their complicity in genocide, apartheid, occupation, and other war crimes and crimes against humanity, chiefly by divesting and disclosing their finances. The walls were hand-painted with etrogs. That's a citrus fruit that's used in Sukkot ritual, with watermelons and pomegranates. There were beautiful portraits of anti-Zionist Jewish ancestors hung from the ceiling. We engaged in the Sukkot ritual. We also held teach-ins on the meanings of Sukkot, you know, understanding that, you know, yes, this was, you know, we wanted to very much have this be a space for Jews and non-Jews to gather on campus. as well as teach-ins on divestment. And a lot of the day was really beautiful and really calm. And it was a very sweet scene. And that evening, or I guess I'll to answer one of your questions. One of the things that UCLA has aimed to do, right, is to say that Jewish students need to be able to access all of campus. This was something that came out of the encampment in the spring. And so here we were, Jewish students seeking to access part of campus in order to observe this holiday.
Thank you. Yeah. Mm.
So how long after the protest began did UCLA officials, such as campus security, demand that the sukkah be dismantled? And did they also say the protest itself, with or without structures, could or could not continue?
So pretty soon after the sukkah went up, which was around 8:30, 9 in the morning, staff from student affairs did come by. And they, you know, they questioned what we were doing, certainly. And they did note that the sukkah was not erected in one of the quote unquote public expression areas, which now amount to about less than 2% of the campus. And also that the structure itself would violate the new time, place, and manner policies, which don't allow for temporary structures. Now, on the other hand, there was a recent injunction passed because a few Jewish students had alleged that the university restricted their access to parts of campus. And the university sort of acknowledged that and said that they would need to provide Jewish access for Jewish students to campus. And so, yeah, once again, that's what we were doing.
All right. Okay. Now let's really get down to it, if you will, because things got a little hairy after all of this. So why don't you take us through the rest of the day and until the night when it apparently was over for the moment. Hit the main highlights for us. That is, for example, I understand some pro-Israeli group threatened to come to campus and beat up the protesters if UCLA did not shut it down. And that a pro-Palestinian faculty group, though, tried to come to your defense. And that a few dozen UCLA students were also gathered there for a teach-in on divestment. A banner was hung at Perloff Hall and so forth. So give us a sense of what it was like during the day, what happened, what were the big moments that happened to kind of let our audience understand how this went.
Absolutely. So I would say through mid-morning or, well, really early afternoon, there were teach-ins being held on Sukkot as a holiday, on divestment. Students well into the afternoon were painting banners with messages that read "Stop Arming Israel," demanded, you know, continued to demand university divestment. These were painted and hung. And so much of the day really had a really nice tenor to it. You know, there were some moments where people stopped by and clearly had some, they disagreed with what was taking place. But it really wasn't until later that evening that things escalated. As you mentioned in your introduction, Ben Shapiro was giving a talk on campus last night. Monday night. And this was, you know, this is a right-wing political commentator. At his talk, he not only said he would not condemn the actions of the Israeli military, but said that he celebrates them. This is also a noted homophobe. And so, you know, it seems like counter-protesters who attended his event came over to the sukkah afterwards, so around 8 p.m. And they also were joined by some other of the kind of regular cast of characters who seem ready to pounce on any action in the area that is in solidarity with Palestine. They harassed the students who were there. They joked about blowing students up by handing out pagers. And made hurled pretty lewd homophobic and racist comments. The police, who were clad in riot gear, who pretty much seemed at the ready, moved in. And so
LAPD police, campus police, which?
So there had been campus security around all day. These were, I don't know what agency, but these were not private security. These were law enforcement officers.
Gotcha. Go ahead.
Yes. And they came in. This really feels like a sort of replay of what happened in the spring, right? Where there's this pretext of the safety of students, you know, the fear of, say, like mob violence. And so what happens is the speech and political activity gets shut down. So police started clearing the area, at which point counter protesters went in and tore up the sukkah. Tore down these images of ancestors and, you know, really important historical figures who many of us hold very dearly in our hearts. It was very emotional to see the hand-painted canvas walls of the sukkah, a religiously mandated structure, ripped. But police had cleared the area. And after they issued a dispersal order, facilities workers came in and hauled the rest of the sukkah away.
Wow. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Maria Hall with the Lawyers Guild Show, here with my co-host Jim Lafferty. And also we're speaking with Benjamin Kirsten from UCLA, Jewish Voice for Peace. And just a 10-second reminder, it's KPFK's fund drive time. And just by listening, you are already casting your vote for freedom of the press, freedom for diverse voices and independent thought. And you can amplify your support by making your pledge at kpfk.org. Okay, so Benjamin, what happens next? If you can share kind of the plans, you know, what are the students doing? What is your group planning now?
Absolutely. So, you know, I will say that public protest is one of many strategies that we and others on campus will take up as we continue to fight for divestment. As a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, I feel really committed to the work of building out community and a base of this social movement, especially being on campus. I feel there's a real need for political education and programming around, say, anti-Semitism that works against the, what is rapidly becoming codified as a definition of anti-Semitism that includes anti-Zionism, which, you know, we soundly disagree with. So we will continue to keep up the pressure.
Yeah, let me ask you this. I suspect a lot of our listeners might want to know the answer to this question, I guess. It strikes me that what you did, correct me if I'm wrong, and I wasn't there, but it sounds to me as though, setting aside the technicalities of having applied for a permit to do this, the structure you built was not 50 or 100 tents. It was something, I know, so often sukkahs, I grew up in a neighborhood where I saw them all the time, are often, I don't know, the size of a phone booth. This one may have been bigger, okay, but it wasn't a monster. It wasn't blocking anybody from getting anywhere they wanted to get on campus, as I've looked at the views of it, and so forth and so on. So I'm not sure how it violated the spirit of their rules, in any event, for them to react as they did. But let me ask you this. In light of these new rules, and I ask it in the context, because this is a problem all over the country. As I think I mentioned in my introduction, NYU has gone so far as to say that to put up an anti-Zionism sign or speak about is to be anti-Semitic, which would have made, of course, where you can name people more. They offered Einstein the chance to be the head of the new country of Israel when it was formed. He said, an anti-Zionist? A religious community? That's discriminatory. Why would I want to be? I wouldn't do it. And he and a lot of other prominent Jews said I wouldn't be a part of that kind of a Jewish state. Well, we can talk about that. But so at any rate, have you given any thought to applying ahead of time for this? If turned down, taking that issue perhaps to court as well? Because this is clearly an effort to stop free speech as we know it on the college campuses. And if not, why not go that way? Either some, this struck me as a very imaginative way of bringing your message to campus, as I say, in the spirit of these new, more restrictive regulations on protest. Even that didn't satisfy the university. So talk to me about that.
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, these are decisions we weighed in the planning process. I think the comparison to NYU is really interesting because while UCLA has not gone so far as to declare Zionist a protected class in that way, it's clear that these restrictions are much more about, even though they won't say as much, about the content of the protest. And about the fact that these are actions that are in solidarity with Palestine. In this case, we, you know, sought to take the university really at its word, that it values Jewish safety, that it would do what it could to provide Jewish students with access to campus. And so that's what we were pushing up against. You know, I think in the future, we will certainly kind of, yeah, find other ways to poke holes and challenge these various repressive policies, draconian policies, as you
call them. Well, I think you definitely showed the university is trying to simply stop your kind of protest, period, restricting it to an area that represents, as you say, maybe less than 2% of the whole damn campus, and it's a huge sprawling campus, blah, blah, blah. But at any rate, because we do have to do some business around money, sadly, and by the way, I think money is one of the reasons why these universities are doing it. They don't want to insult anybody who wants to donate. Of course, that's more important than free speech and academic freedom, for God's sake. But before we have to move on, because of that, I just want to personally thank you and Jewish Voice for Peace. I can tell you, as someone who isn't quite as young as you are, Maria, you stop that now. It wasn't quite as young as you are by about 60 years. Is so pleased to meet you, so pleased to know that there are people who prepare, particularly because we may be facing an even worse situation around freedom of speech in the next couple of weeks than we face today, knowing that you and others like you are out there trying in a very peaceful way and a very intelligent and open-hearted way to nevertheless speak your piece. And that is of a benefit to all of us. Let's hope it doesn't become all too rare a benefit for all of us. But I thank you. It gives us all hope. We thank you very much, Benjamin Kirsten. Now, I do want to just spend the last few minutes before we go to our next topic. But Maria's already told you, it's the last third, I think, of our fun drive. And we don't spend, you know, third of the program anymore talking about why you should pitch. This is our pledge drive. That's a politer way of saying it's for money. That's what it's for. We don't get it from the government. We don't take it from Archer Daniels Midland, like a lot of public radio stations do. We only get it from you. You're our big corporate sponsors. You are listeners. You're what keep our station on the air. As I've said every time we talk about this, and when you do that, you make quite a contribution to the progressive cause in Los Angeles, because Benjamin's probably not been called up to speak on CNN tonight, or maybe he has, I doubt it. Most of our guests are from the movement, the progressive movement here in Los Angeles, that doesn't have a radio station it can count on, like they can count on this station, to bring their message, to bring their side of the story about what is going on in this country to you, the listeners. You listen because you appreciate free speech radio. Well, my friends, in this, you know, capitalist country, it ain't free. And so we do need you to give us support. Go to our website at kpfk.org. When you do, you're helping the entire progressive cause of Los Angeles. You'll feel better. I always do when I contribute. $25, you're a full-fledged member. But there are lots of ways on our website that we thank you with books and movies and bags to take to the grocery store and everything else, you know, with our logo on it, and that you can turn on, use as gifts yourself. But most importantly, you continue to get the gift of free speech radio and without any commercials and what have you. And so please do that, kpfk.org, or give us a call right now at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. We'd love to hear from you. It makes our people are answering the phones feel nice to hear from you. Make sure the station keeps on the air. In this period ahead, no matter who's elected on the 5th, boy, are we going to need this station. Let's hope not as much as I fear, but we're going to need this station. So do contribute, do pledge, do support the station, do become a part of the KPFK and the progressive family here in Los Angeles. Maria, last thoughts before we have to go to a station break?
Yes, I think just the power of media and independent voices, independent journalism. What is it that fascists love the most? That is to buy all of the media so that they can give their propaganda. So we are not that, but unfortunately, it does make it a challenge to pay the bills and keep the lights on. So we rely on a vision of many, many people giving a little bit, and that's how we want to keep it going.
Yeah. And so stay with us. We're going to take a brief station ID break here on the Lawyers Guild Show. But then we're going to be right back with you. And we'll get a very important topic about a proposition on the ballot that maybe that doesn't get as much attention, frankly, as it should. It's critically important here in L.A., Proposition 6. We're going to talk to you about it, give you the real true story on it. Stay tuned. We'll be back with you shortly, my friends.
When we say this is listener-supported free speech radio, what are we really saying? The free speech radio part is about thought-provoking, challenging programming that uncovers stories you wouldn't normally hear on the radio. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for those programs and the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything it takes to bring you this service. So here's a very large thank you to you, a listener in listener-supported free speech radio. And if you haven't yet gone from listener to supporter, please do so now. Give online at kpfk.org.
You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show here on KPFK. I'm still Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. And now we're going to talk to you about a rather important matter. I think a long overdue matter. It's rather shameful, actually, when you think about how long it's overdue. Proposition 6. Maria, let us know what that's all about and who our guest is.
All right. Well, yes, it's just 12 days to go before our big election. And with the presidential race dominating the headlines, we're here to remind you to do your homework about all of the other important races and issues that voters will be deciding. Our focus today is on Proposition 6, a ballot measure that will, if passed, ban all slavery in California. Now you may be thinking, wait a minute, why do we need that? Slavery was abolished in the United States with the ratification of the 13th Amendment back in 1865, right? Well, yes, but there is an exception in both the U.S. and California constitutions. And that exception is slavery or involuntary servitude can be imposed as punishment for a crime. So what would this change actually mean if people doing jail or prison time can no longer be forced to work? How would it change prison life? And how might it impact the rest of society? Well, to help us answer these and other questions, our guest today is attorney Carmen Nicole Cox, Director of Government Affairs for ACLU California Action. Prior to joining ACLU California Action, Carmen spent nearly a decade focusing on criminal justice reform and the root causes of mass incarceration, including as Chief Counsel of Public Policy and Advocacy at United Way California, Capital Region, Deputy Director at For the People, Deputy Legal Affairs Secretary for Governor Jerry Brown, Chief of Legislation at the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and Deputy District Attorney in San Joaquin County. A self-described liberation attorney, Carmen is motivated to fight for poverty alleviation and decarceration, in part because her own father died alone on the floor of a prison cell just weeks before his scheduled release. Carmen believes that responsible and compassionate reforms are motivated by love of people based in evidence and developed by individuals with lived experience. Carmen Nicole Cox, a warm welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Oh my goodness, Maria, Jim, thank you so much for having me.
Happy to see you.
Sure. And just a quick reminder to listeners, neither KPFK 90.7 FM nor the Lawyers Guild Show endorses any particular candidate or issue. We're just getting you all the information so you can make your informed decisions. Okay, so Attorney Carmen Nicole Cox, in broad strokes, what exactly is Proposition 6 and how did it make its way onto the November 5th, 2024 ballot?
It's a great question. So Proposition 6 is a constitutional amendment, and it amends language that has been in California's constitution since 1850. So before the 13th Amendment, we had this language that permits forced labor in this state that entered the Union as a free state and claims to have never practiced or endorsed slavery. So what Proposition 6 is going to do is address this current practice that essentially says we can force, we can extract, we can take human labor from folks who are inside under threat of punishment. And the current system prioritizes that forced labor over rehabilitative needs and therapeutic needs of the folks inside. So the reason we have Prop 6 right now, we need Prop 6 right now, is because our recidivism rates are high. It's because the cost of harm to victims is quite honestly incalculable. Prop 6 is just a common sense approach that says we ought to prioritize rehabilitation in a way that allows folks to both work part-time and prioritize their rehabilitation so they're less likely to reoffend when they come home. This is about community safety. It's also about taxpayer dollars. Right now, we're using them in a way that makes absolutely no sense. We are fueling, we are funding this revolving door in and out of jails and prisons. It costs taxpayer dollars. It costs community safety, right? And so that's Prop 6. We're saying $14 billion just on prisons alone makes no sense if you're not actually preparing people for reentry.
Well, gee, that sounds like too rational by that idea. I laughed only not to cry. I mean, you know, but let's be clear. What are the current rules in jails and prisons, Carmen, you know, regarding forcing people to work? What kind of work are they forced to do? Are they earning any wages at all when they do it? Tell us about what kind of work they're doing. Who are they working for, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, thank you. I'll start by just making sure I am responsive to the last point of your question, Maria, which is how did we get here? This is actually placed on the ballot by a bipartisan vote of the legislature. So that means it required a supermajority in each house to get out of the legislature. We did that with bipartisan support, and we did that only after significant negotiations with Governor Newsom's team, because, of course, he's responsible for the safety and operations of the prisons. In terms of the current rules, so while the state constitution mirrors the federal constitution and permits slavery, calling it involuntary servitude, we actually have state law, Penal Code Section 2700, that mandates the secretary to require every incarcerated person to perform as much labor as essentially the secretary so requires. So the actual mandate to take advantage of the constitutional provision is in state law. And so that Prop 6, when we got it out of the legislature, at the same time, the governor signed a bill that requires CDCR to actually establish voluntary work programs, because we absolutely do need the work programs. Folks need those work programs because otherwise they don't get out of their cells, right? They also don't earn dollars. Jim, you say what kind of work do they do and do they earn anything? Well, folks inside do anything from slaughtering cows for commercial.
Agribusiness.
For agribusiness. They farm alfalfa. They package pistachios. They sew laundry. They make the eyeglasses that we provide to Medi-Cal patients. They cook. They clean. They repair all inside of the institutions. And as we know, they fight fires. They make license plates. The vast majority of folks make, recently, I think in June or July of this year, CDCR doubled the minimum wage. So I think it went from 8 cents an hour to 16 cents an hour. Not I think. The minimum wage went from 8 cents an hour to 16 cents an hour. And but if you're fighting fires, for example, you're making $1 a day plus $2 an hour when you're on the fire line. And nobody else makes as much as the firefighter. So you're making anywhere between 16 cents an hour to up to $2 an hour. And that's not true. There are some folks, a limited number of folks who work for private business. They do coding and this sort of thing, and they make the same minimum wage that we have here. So they do some of everything, including maintaining the operations of the institutions. And folks would, they sign up to do these jobs once they're told they don't have a choice. But even once they have a choice, they'll sign up to do these jobs. But people should be able to sign up to do the jobs. We should not be forcing folks to work. And to your question about the rules, Jim, so here's what happened. If a person who, let's say that they work in hospice care inside of the institutions, because that's the thing that they do. So they take care of folks who are in their last days and they clean them, they take them to and from gardens, they feed them. And let's say their patient passes away and they'd like to call off work, right? Because they're grieving. They don't, there is no bereavement leave. And if they do take an unapproved day off work, they get written up. That write-up means they could absolutely lose their parole date. It means they will definitely lose earned a certain number of earned credits. It means they could be confined to their cell, solitary confinement. It means that they won't, if you're a mom, right, and you took the day off work, you called off work, you didn't get it approved, it means you'll lose visitation with your children. Not you might, you do. Once you get written up, these are the consequences that follow.
And so, I mean, just also thank you for that, but I'm just thinking, you know, this capitalist society, you know, free enterprise and all that crap, I would think that there must be some agribusinesses who are paying their workers, not enough, but they're paying them a hell of a lot more than 16 cents an hour. Mm-hmm. How is that fair competition? Why aren't they suing the state for the discrimination that places on them trying to make a profit versus the agribusiness that's getting cheap labor, slave labor?
It's very interesting, Jim, that the Constitution only permits government to exploit labor this way.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And wow. You're going to say, Maria?
Oh, no, go ahead. Finish your thought, please.
No, I'm just going to say that it's so very important that we make sure that folks are not being denied opportunities for rehabilitation just so that someone, whether it's the government saving money or some corporation increasing their profit margins, that should not happen. If it happened at all, it certainly shouldn't happen at the expense of folks being rehabilitated and coming back home to our communities. Right. And that is what happens now. You can't just say, no, I don't want to go to work today because there's a program I want to go to. The regulations specifically say, we'll take into consideration your mental health or anger management or parenting classes that you might need. But what will take precedent are the needs of the operations in the facilities.
Well, speaking of the communities outside of jails and prisons, tell us why you think Proposition 6 would be a step in the right direction for our society as a whole.
Thank you for that. Well, the status quo is, it's morally wrong. It's anti-public safety. It's fiscally foolish, right? We already, in terms of it being morally wrong, it's slavery. Involuntary servitude is slavery. Period. There's nothing more that needs to be said there. So in a state like California, where we claim to be this bastion of progressive policies, and where we say that we are a California for all that cares greatly about equality and equity and justice, we cannot continue to allow this theft of labor and this essentially this arcane system that prioritizes rehabilitation or prioritizes exploitation actually over rehabilitation. From the anti-public safety lens, I don't just say that to be flippant. Honestly, people are coming home and going back at rates that are not justifiable. You cannot defend our continued investment with this level, this lack of efficacy. Mm-hmm. Every single time someone comes home and commits another crime, there is a victim, right? And that victim is at a loss that we can't even calculate, right? But then we also pay into victims' compensation. You know, there's like all of these systems that are being implicated, which really takes us to the fiscally foolish, but all of these systems that are implicated that we're investing in, but that aren't working. People want to be safe in their communities. And so if they're paying $130,000+ a year for somebody to be incarcerated in prison, that person should come home and be less likely to be a threat to public safety. Mm-hmm. And the fiscally foolish side, $130,000 a person, $14 billion a year, that is twice as much as the most expensive university in California with less than half the efficacy. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't add up.
Well, it sure doesn't. I have to assume that this Proposition 6 has some opposition to it. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce jumps to mind for some strange reason, or, half of corporate America. But just seriously, I don't know if they're actually on the record about this or not, but who the devil is opposing this?
Yeah.
Are they talking about it? Are they spending lots of money to defeat it? Talk to us about that.
Great question. So when we were in the legislature, we had no formal opposition. And again, we had bipartisan support. I think towards the end in the Senate, there were less than a handful of Republican senators who voted no. Less than a handful. Because quite honestly, you don't want to be on record opposing the abolition of slavery in the state of California in 2024. And also, when you look on your voter guide, you'll see that there is no formal opposition. No one registered opposition for Proposition 6 because who wants to be permanently on record having taken that position? Since we've gone to ballot, we've gotten endorsements from well over 100 organizations, from elected officials, from labor unions. But we've also seen the Howard Jarvis Taxpayer Association come out in opposition. And, you know, these folks are... Quite honestly, there's some naivete there. Folks have some concern that this will cost more money, but actually it's going to save us money. The Legislative Analyst Office never suggested, and that's who's responsible for doing the, alongside the Department of Finance, is responsible for doing the assessment, what would this cost the California public? And they never said, oh, they may have to hire more correctional officers. Folks are like, well, but maybe they'll have to increase wages. Prop 6 does not increase wages. The bill that I mentioned before that requires the secretary to establish a voluntary work program, that bill explicitly says that the secretary of CDCR establishes wages inside of the prisons and that the city and county officials establish wages inside of the jails. So quite honestly, if we're being intellectually honest, there's not increased cost. But there is a substantial likelihood that we're going to reduce our costs. And then we'll be back fighting to make sure all of those cost savings are put into the community for community safety services.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to follow up a little bit on that fiscal cost. So I noticed in the official voter information guide, it said the fiscal impact is uncertain. So what are some of the reasons why it's hard to predict what the benefit or, you know, cost, you know, which way it would go, and also what the range might be?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the cost, that I think was the LAO and the Department of Finance are legally obligated to talk with multiple stakeholders. And there are some stakeholders who have presented the hypothetical that folks will be able to demand more pay inside. And so they had to take that into consideration, as well as they took into consideration the fact that if folks are actually able to prioritize rehabilitation, they may actually earn their way out sooner, which would have the result of reducing the $134,000 that we spend each year on folks who are inside. And then additionally, we definitely want to make clear that if folks are not coming out and going back in and coming out and going back in, we're saving all kinds of costs, not just the cost of jail or prison. It's the cost associated with the cops coming out, with the judges and the prosecutors and the defense attorneys engaging in the prosecution practice. Like, there is so much that could be saved if we invest in reducing recidivism, which is what Prop 6 does.
It would seem to me as though this proposition is an enormous first step And I want to stress both enormous and first stamp. And I know this always gets awkward for people who are putting ballot measures on. It's like with the folks we've had on, you know, a life without parole as opposed to the death penalty. And many of us are opposed to the death penalty and wish that was, but, you know, but life without parole is an amazing first step. No arguing with that. Under this, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, they still will get these miserable wages, but it's voluntary. And that's the enormous first step, it seems to me, morally, legally, and politically, an enormous first step. And then I'm just wondering, and you don't have to comment on this, or maybe you don't know what the thinking is of people who put this on the ballot. I would hope that somewhere down the road we'll be talking to somebody who's put a ballot measure on that says, and when they do this voluntarily, all right, they have their room and board, quote unquote, paid for. They don't necessarily have to be paid what the worker out in the street who's got to find a place to live and feed his kids is earning or she's earning. But by damn, it isn't going to be 18 cents an hour. So you want to make any comments about that? Fine. If not, we can just...
I do. Because you make such a good point. There is a movement underway to ensure that all Californians, all of our family members, all of our friends are treated with respect and dignity. And that includes how we compensate folks for their human talent, labor, and skills. And there was a small but mighty and bolstered by many other organizations that moved what was ACA 8 in the legislature through the legislature to become Proposition 6. And that was the 10P program, Anti-Recidivism Coalition, Sister Warriors, Communities United for Restorative Youth Justice, my organization, ACLU California Action, Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. And these same organizations, plus many more I couldn't possibly name, are also involved with legislation that is looking at wages inside, because that is, in fact, part of a larger conversation. Prop 6 can't do that. You can't do it all at one time, and Prop 6 won't have the result or doesn't automatically change wages. But absolutely, it's worth considering. Folks are considering it as part of a larger movement, really just for human dignity in the state of California, no matter where you find yourself situated.
Well, Carmen, I wanted to ask also, I know we are running out of time, but I wanted to get this one in. What about other states? Have any other states passed laws like Proposition 6, banning slavery and involuntary servitude unconditionally, even if it's in punishment for a crime?
Yeah. So believe it or not, Alabama and Tennessee have already beat us to it. Vermont, Rhode Island, Nebraska, Colorado, Utah, Oregon, all within the last, since about 2020, maybe one goes back until to 2018. California is just one of 16 states that continues to have, approve, endorse, permit slavery in its constitution and in practice. So we are for sure behind the times, and this is absolutely policy change that is past due.
We do have to run on and spend a few minutes here on urging our listeners to support us. Before we let you go, is there a website? I mean, other than, I know you're urging people to vote yes on Proposition 6, is there some place where people could go that you'd refer them to if they want to know more about it or your work? Give us that before we have to say goodbye.
Yes, thank you. So, super easy, voteyesprop6.com. Also, vote yes on Prop 6. And then whether you've voted yet or haven't voted yet, please do check out voteyesprop6.com. You can also find us on Instagram, yes on Prop 6. And you can join folks like Dolores Huerta and Angela Davis and Michelle Alexander and Mayor Bass in LA and the LA Board of Supervisors and the Coalition Against Slavery and Human Trafficking in LA. Like, there are so many folks, the California Democratic Party, the Teachers Association, the firefighters, right? Like the United Auto Workers. There are so many entities and organizations and individuals that are supporting Prop 6, including we have a day of action. I would love to be able to get information. I don't know how to do that.
Go to the website, right? Or go to...
You're right. October 30th, 5:30 to 7:30, national phone banking in support of Prop 6, because this is a national movement.
Well, Attorney Carmen Nicole Cox, I thank you for your work personally. I salute your work, and I thank you so much for being here on the Lawyers Guild Show with us today. I hope we've helped enlighten some people, and we'll have you back again when it's time to do that. So thank you for now.
And thank you so much.
I would just add it in light of what Carmen said. You'll be in good company. Clearly, if you decide to vote yes on it, that's your decision. You'll be in great company if you decide to give us a call at 818-985-5735. $25 and you're a full-fledged member. You get to vote on the issues we vote on here and what have you. We know some of you are working and not making enough to hardly pay the rent. No hard feelings if you keep listening. But we know a lot of you out there are doing pretty damn well, and you're listening too, and that's great. But maybe you want to contribute $100 to pay for four people who can't afford to pay their $25, or for eight people. It wouldn't cost you much, one dinner out, a couple $100, and you've helped the station tremendously. Go to our website, find lots of ways that we say thank you when you buy you know, little premiums we send to you when you do donate at $200, $1,000. So much a month. There are any number of ways to support the station, 818-985-5735. And then there is, of course, Maria, the website, right?
Yes, that's kpfk.org. And of course, yeah, we're all looking at ways like, what can we do to make things better right now? It's easy to want to put the covers over your head and not go out and face the world, but we need to. That's what we do. We get up, we go outside, and we act. And one way to act is by giving a pledge to kpfk.org. It is easy. It's fun. It will make you feel part of the community because it is a community. There are good people out there. I know sometimes it seems like the might is right, but it's not true.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've seen big billboards all over town. Why you should vote no on the rent control initiative. And I've listened to their very expensive commercials on television. We did a show here at KPFK about all those ballot measures. Those commercials are lying through their teeth, misrepresenting in an extraordinarily despicable way what Prop 33 is about. However you feel about it, you're not getting the true scoop from those billboards or those big fancy television ads. Well, the people on the other side don't necessarily have that kind of money, but we put them here on KPFK. The folks like Carmen, Nicole Cox, who was just with us, they're not necessarily all over the airways either. That's why we say we're part of the progressive community here, the humanist community, if you will, the take people first community, if you will, by putting their voices on. And when you contribute to us, you're contributing to their work in the sense of their right to do their work, to have their work known, to be able to compete in this hugely television and radio market where they can't afford to compete any other way. But we bring them on here so that the whole story is told, not just the rich guy's story. KPFK.org, you go to our website, you see lots of ways we say thank you when you do. We like to think that listening to the Lawyers Guild Show and all the other wonderful programs here are thanks enough. But just saying thank you, and we appreciate that, that's not enough. Sadly, if we could pay the electric bill with your thanks, we'd be rich because we're constantly getting thanked from folks. And we do appreciate that, believe me. But I say, hey, thanks. That's great. Contribute to the station. Right, Maria? It's not enough.
That's right. And it is time to wrap, though.
All right. Well, then on behalf of Maria Hall, myself, Jim Lafferty, we thank you for listening to the Lawyers Guild Show today. We'll be back with you next week with the truth some more about an issue that's important to us all. Until then, my friends, stay healthy. And as the song's about to tell you, make sure you stand up for your rights.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me.
Well, the presidential debates are over. Or are they? On October 23rd, listeners sponsored KPFK will broadcast live the final presidential debate hosted by Free and Equal Elections. They have invited the presidential nominees from all the parties.
Vote for me and I'll set you free.
Chase Oliver, Randall Terry, and Jill Stein have confirmed and will be in Los Angeles for this final debate. By the way, KPFK's mission is to provide a platform for underrepresented voices and perspectives. Even if you agree or disagree with those voices, we allow you to be the judge. So free and equal elections did not censor who was allowed on the debate stage. Join us for the candidates who accepted this invitation and will be on this final presidential debate.